Accession number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, reel 14. Now, can we just, you mentioned just at the end of the last reel, the Meteor. Well, what did you think of the Meteor to fly? It's just test flying it. Is it just getting a bit of experience?
Well, that's right. It was just to fly the type which was actually used then for towing up at Sylt. We had the two Derwents in it, and it really, it went up extremely well. The Meteor had a good rate of climb, you know, as an interceptor, and that was the T7 was unpressurized, but had been used for training parallel with the Vampire. But I'd only flown the Vampire, so I was lucky to be able to chat someone up at Sylt, and he quickly checked me out on the Meteor. And the Meteor, of course, had quite high losses from the asymmetric side, where sadly, perhaps overdoing the exploring of every bit of the flight envelope in the typical Royal Air Force and Central Flying School way, they ended up, sadly, in retrospect, losing more people carrying out the procedure of flying at low speeds on one engine, and with that engine out to start with, not just throttle back, but the whole engine out in the early days. But by then, we just practiced asymmetric with the actual throttle back, not stopcocked. But that was the only major thing about the Meteor, because they were, as you probably remember, the engines were right in the middle of the straight wings on either side, and if one of those was out, you had quite a high turning moment, and that meant that at low speed, you know, you used to have to yourself, under tuition to start with, sort out what speed you could actually hold the aircraft level on one engine. And it was practicing that and other losses, initially with an instrument problem, because the Meteor had such excellent acceleration that to start with, at night and in bad weather, after takeoff, the artificial horizon had precessional problems, so that it gave you false readings because of the very rapid acceleration, and that it could lead you into, if you didn't make certain that you had a full rate of climb, and people were lost on that, and there was it was about 300 or 400 yards to the right, 1500 yards off the end of the runway, something like that, where people sadly went in. But that was altered, and again, that was added to what I was saying on the instrument, understanding the instruments, because by this time, and the Hunter's instrument had got over that, so that the artificial horizon didn't have these errors. It was all taken out with the construction and technology in the artificial horizon.
Now, what about the Swift?
Well, the Swift, it was great to fly that, but
what is
the other way around. The Swift then was had been and gone in the fighter side, because originally the Swift 1 had been the competitor to the Hunter, and amazingly, if you look back at all the flights and aeroplanes, Supermarine, who had designed and developed the Spitfire, the Swift sadly was completely the other way round. You know, if the Hurricane was slightly slower and a bit sort of felt a bit more heavy and pedestrian compared with the Spitfire, the Swift was exactly the other way around compared with the Hunter. And a lot of money was spent promoting the Swift. And I think really it was probably because it was not going to be a good fighter, because it was very heavy, and always called it brick-built. And it was a bit like that, but it had by then, because it had failed in the fighter role, been developed from the Swift 1 to the Mark 5, which was in use with the reconnaissance squadrons. And in that role, it was good, although we did have losses and problems with engines. And at one stage, we were losing one Swift in Germany on average once a month for 5 months. I can remember that vividly. But What was intriguing to me was to compare it with a Hunter. Rough and ready terms, you could say that unless you were in afterburner, it had an afterburner, which the Hunter didn't. Unless you were in afterburner and below 15,000 feet, there was no contest, because I mean the Hunter's handling was really much better in many ways, and it's the whole way it performed, its rate of turn and everything. But in its role, the Swift was a popular aircraft with the recce pilots, and it was slightly easier to at low level. The Hunter was developed eventually as a fighter reconnaissance aircraft, and modifications were made to some of the instruments and some of the trimming, etc. But the Hunter, you weren't easily able to fly it hands off. At altitude, what we often did on, if you were just on long range, if you're flying to UK, a lot of people didn't know this or do it, but you could actually flick it into manual, and then it could be trimmed out absolutely perfectly. It would, in manual, you know, in other words, without your main hydraulics. But, you know, that was a slightly irrational thing, apart from that if you're at night or something like that, it was the easy way to do it.
Now, anything else before? I mean, you know, you did this gunnery thing at the SIL. That was towards the end of your time.
Yes, and what I probably didn't say was I'd already been told or gone down for interview with the commander-in-chief, Air Marshal Sir Humphrey Edwards-Jones, and I'd hoped that it wasn't going to happen to me, but because I'm sure my new wing commander flying at Goodislow had sort of warned him off. But the poor bloke, I think, was pretty desperate to have an ADC, and even though I went down and said no to almost every question, he said, you know, did I play tennis, and did I play golf, and did I this and did I that? And in a strange way, he was a bit like my father, who was a bit, if required, would tend to steamroller if you didn't stick up for yourself. And it was a rather interesting interview that I've never forgotten, because although I'd said no to every question that he asked me and tried to give him the wrong answer, I ended up being told that I was to go down for that job.
Now, so that's aide-de-camp.
Aide-de-camp, that's right, to the commander. He was commander to ATAF, so that was, he had dual responsibilities. He was commander of the British side, that was the 2nd Tactical Air Force, the 2nd Tactical Air Force was within, by then, the 2nd Allied Tactical Air Force. It's slightly complicated for people to understand, but the 2nd Allied Tactical Air Force had the Belgians in it and the Dutch in it and the Germans coming into it. And that element, when eventually I started, it was fine. But going back quickly
so
to the...
Hang on, your headquarters, 2nd...
2nd Allied Tactical Air Force, yeah. 2nd ATAF, which was... down at Rheindahlen. Yes, that's Rheindahlen, Rheindahlen, no. And that was also known as Mönchengladbach, and that's M-O, normally M-O with an umlaut on it, N-C-H-E-N, and then second word. Was I too fast there?
No, you're right. I know.
And then Gladbach, which is G-L-A-D-B-A-C-H, and that was the headquarters. And it was a reasonably new headquarters. It had only been up for several...
Now, when did you go there?
I believe it was September. It's on that sheet. I'm sorry. My feel for it is it's September 1959, just after the gunnery meet. And in fact, sadly, I've been told up there in the middle of the... rather vital stage what was going to happen, and I don't think I'd have been able to go down on Cazaux on the team any rate, because I'll sort of get to that later, but at that time, sadly, we were also having, I was having perhaps a bit of bad luck, I don't know, with the harmonization, because after three or four trips of doing this two-burst attacks, the very careful harmonization that we had, whether we were losing that a bit, I don't know, because of the intensity of the flying, but also having been told that I probably wouldn't be on at any rate, all I'm saying is that I think I had certainly one trip, if not two trips, where, because with air firing, you really need to have to concentrate and that. And I think I was slightly thrown off my balance then, knowing that I wouldn't be in the team at any rate.
Now, so you were going to be, now, at the time, was it Air Chief Marshal? Or
Sir Humphrey Edwards Jones, yeah. He was known as...
Was it Edwards Jones hyphenated then?
No, two separate words. But he was known as EJ, intriguingly, and EJ was almost invariably put E-J as a kind of...
was he an Air Chief Marshal?
No, he was an Air Marshal.
Air Marshal, right.
And Air Marshal Sir Humphrey Edwards Jones. And what was rather splendid was... he was the first, he was the first service person to fly the Spitfire before it was a Spitfire. So this is 1936, shortly after I was born. In fact, it was the Spitfire first flew, not as a Spitfire, as you know, in March, beginning March 1936. And my birth date was on the 13th, which was the following week. But he flew it later in the year, but he was the he was a test pilot then, as a flight lieutenant in at Martlesham Heath, where British Telecom are now. But that was the equivalent before the war of what Boscombe Down became
now,
after the war.
What was he like? Because you were going to be his ADC.
Yes. I mean, my vivid memory was arriving. Well, a word of a lie. This sounds out of a completely unbelievable. The very first letter that was in the in tray, and it was at the top of the group of letters, absolutely inexplicably a coincidence, the very first letter I opened was from Central Flying School, 200, asking, I think it was either from Central Flying School or Flying Training Command, or both, but it was just the one letter saying, why had I not turned up for the number 200 course for qualified flying instructors, the flying instructors course at Little Rissington. And of course, what had actually happened, that the actual CNC had said to me, if I didn't take this at the end of the interview, he said, if you don't take this job, you will end up down a hole. And I believed him then, because I mean, lots of people then were being sent down a hole or off to
by down
missile.
A hole, you just mean to a bad post?
No, well, it was a radar. I mean, that was the kind of jargon for you get a very bad posting, and that down a hole literally was, you know, to do with the radar side. In other words, you'd do a ground job any rate. And right. So really, all I was saying was that it was obvious that not only had the group captain in charge of personnel, he was known as the SPSO, the Senior Personnel Staff Officer, at headquarters, obviously known about what was going on, but also I think the CNC himself had perhaps told me something that was completely incorrect, because one imagines that the command would have known that I was already on the instructor's course, and that this was withheld from me. So in a way, I almost within 1 minute flat, my rather naive ideas about the realities of the Royal Air Force and what would happen or could happen up at headquarters. And it was really opened my eyes, because obviously I'd been joked for this job in a way, and my posting, which was there safely, had been sort of withheld from me. But looking back, what was really splendid about it in a way, and one could joke, because he was the only commander. I mean, he was senior enough then as an air marshal, but I think everyone before, and I think almost everyone after, had gone up to air chief marshal. And, you know, I always felt that in a way he might have screwed my career, but in a way he didn't go higher either. So, but what was lovely...
Like? What was your job? What was the job as ADC?
Well, really what I'd like to say, it was slightly different from normal, because part of his attraction to me is he said, you can do this job for a year and that's all it'll be, because he knew that he could not do much more than a year out there. And that was his part of the deal for this business of saving me from going down the ground hole. And I think from the time I was interviewed and then went back on the squadron, and then it all happened within a few days, I was back down at headquarters. That, as I say, was his part of the bargain. And what was good was that he knew he was leaving the service and was not going up beyond that period. That was his final tour. But what was extremely good was that it was an international headquarters, and there was that international element. And I was meeting people from the German Luftwaffe, because they were just starting again. And for instance, Kammhuber, General Kammhuber, I remember meeting, who was the Kammhuber line in the in World War II for the defence of Germany, the air defence of Germany. And Steinhoff, the famous Mackie Steinhoff, was there, the chap who was very badly disfigured by an accident he had right at the end of the war, who'd been one of their top fighter pilots, and some very interesting people like that, and also the Dutch and the Belgians who we met. The Canadians and Americans were further south, and they were fourth Allied Tactical Air Force. And occasionally we'd meet their commander, and again he was there were two quite well known blokes commanding there, the 4ATAF. And above us, we reported effectively to just outside Brussels, the headquarters of AFSI, and that was Sir Harry Broadhurst at that stage.
Now,
so Air Chief Marshal Sir Harry Broadhurst was...
What was your job as ADC?
The personal staff of the commander was split into the personal staff officer, PSO, and that was a very pleasant chap called Mike Warby, who I got on well with. And Mike was virtually bilingual. His French was as good as his English. And he was responsible for the more planning and sort of pure military side. And the aide-de-camp's job was more on the ceremonial and the entertaining side, and hosting visits and accompanying the commander wherever he went. And that side worked quite well, because I like Mike and got on well with him. But obviously, in a way, I'd have preferred to do the other job. But there was a splendid chap called Sergeant Clark, who was the CNC's driver. And he also had a German driver called Herring, just spelt the normal way. I think it was H-E-R-I-N-G. But between those two, they were very good at planning arrivals and departures on the pure transport side. But in a way, the ADC had the responsibility to make certain that everything worked all right for the commander when he visited places, and the timing of aircraft, you know, and doors opening and things like that, and meeting people, and also making certain that his sort of social agenda. And he was a very good entertainer. EJ, I think, was well known throughout the Air Force for the depth, I think, and quality of his entertainment. And in a way, the one thing I'd got going for him was that it never bothered me, however late I stayed up at night, because he was really, and that aspect was very interesting, sort of seeing people talking after the dinner parties, because I mean, a dinner parties was an essential part of it, planning the table plans and the conduct of the evenings, and sort of from mixing, you know, cocktails, and it was normally martinis that one started with, I can remember. But he had people like Sir Christopher Steele, who was the British ambassador, would be a guest quite regularly, sort of probably about every three or four months, I'd have thought. And also Sir Harry Broadhurst, and loads of people coming over from England on formal visits, like the new Chief of Air Staff, Sir Dermot Boyle. That was Tony Boyle's father. Tony I knew quite well, who was on my entry at Cranwell. And Sir Tom Pike came through, and Zulu Morris, and a lot of these wartime figures. And to hear them at night talking about the war was absolutely fascinating. And I was very privileged in a way. And that did develop my interest in Air Force history, because there's no way, I don't think, later that I'd have got involved with the Tangmere side, for instance, even though I had links with 1 and 43, helping start the Tangmere Museum, if I hadn't had this sort of grounding and interest. And it, apart from the fact that I'd done, I think, classics, ancient history helped a wee bit that interest in history, but it was really developed considerably by personally meeting these people that had taken a large role in the senior operational fighting side of the war. They'd all been commanders, from squadron leader commanders at the beginning of the sort of Battle of Britain. EJ was one of the first people in the original list that Dowding had. I think it was only 16, from memory, of fighter leaders that were actually nominated to start with. It was quite a small number. He was on 213 from memory at that stage, and 213 was there as one of the Canberra squadrons.
Now, so that your it sounds quite a read. Did you enjoy it in the end, the job? I mean, you didn't want to do it. You'd wanted to.
What was lucky about it, and I don't know whether I should really admit this, but it was quite useful in a funny way every now and again, because you had to get to know people to get your job done, and you met a lot of senior figures. But also the other way around, what was very valuable for me was being able, the CNC quite regularly then was going back to UK. And then often he didn't want me or didn't need me back in UK, and that suited me, because as soon as he was off, I was off like a bunny back to one of about four different stations where I was able to fly. And what was extremely valuable for me was that I at Wildenrath, just down the road, they had NF-11s then, and then they were followed by NF-14s, just literally as hack aircraft that other people didn't want to fly. And I think there was Meteor 7 there as well. I'm pretty certain there were chipmunks down there. And I could leap off and fly very easily, that you could in those days. The guy that ran that, there were two. There was a squadron leader and a flight lieutenant. And both of them had been on Mosquitoes, from memory. And Bruggen was the same. And I can remember flying with Air Commodore Tomlin when he came out, or he might even have been group captain still then, who came out to command Bruggen, because I remember flying with him in the Meteor 7, and then again flying the 11s or 14s at Bruggen, even up at Larbrook and back at Yeaver occasionally, and a lot more at Goodislow, because I kept my links with the squadron. And In fact, one night I went along, and it sounds a bit strange, but because it was, I think, at 9:30 at night or something like that, that I was going down to fly rather late, I rang a friend up and said, you know, I don't know when I'm taking off, but I'll just come over the mess when I arrive. And it was a beautiful, I've never forgotten that, it was a beautiful moonlit night. It was clear as, although it was late at night, it was a perfectly clear night in the moonlight. And I just did two loops over the mess so that he could come down and pick me up with his car, who should be leaving, but at that very instant, without my knowing, but the Wing Commander flying was just at that very instant, had opened the mess door and was just going out on the steps. So I had the unique privilege of being grounded on a ground tour, which I thought was rather good. I was stopped flying for a day. But then what was spent, it was to still stay and get quite a few hunter trips, you know, with the squadron, and then go back again when necessary to meet the CNC. Once I very nearly didn't meet him because I went off very early to Silt with some... the only time I ever flew with a navigator, and his G wasn't working, and it fascinated me that we went all the way up to Silt and down and came back again. But the point of the story is, there we were, I think it was about 10 to 9 from memory. The weather was very bad at Wildenrath, but Wildenrath was a master airfield, and the letdown was very good, and it was very flat round there. And I can remember the airfield was red when you're not really supposed to land at all because the weather's so bad. And this, I was very conscious of this very old man, I suppose he was 40 in the back, if that, this navigator. And he knew jolly well that I was going to land when the airfield was way below limits, but I was supposed to be back in the office. And it was more than my, you know, I didn't want to not have this privilege. And fortunately, you know, everything was all right, and had a very good GCA and landed and rushed off back. But I've never forgotten my only trip in the Air Force with a navigator, when in many ways he wasn't able to help me in any way because of his equipment not being working. But you're right. I did eventually enjoy it, and I met some super people.
What did you think of Edward Jones himself? I mean, as a bloke and as a did you get on well with him?
I think it's sort of slightly difficult to say, really, because
did you like him?
The strange thing was, he'd partly picked me, I think, because he knew about the fact that I'd been right down to Istanbul on this long trip, and in a way he went off himself and had done a similar thing with his car, because he'd also travelled that way. And I'm trying to think exactly where he had
been.
Doesn't
matter. I mean,
But he almost knew too much about Second TAF. That sounds odd for a commander, but in a way, and it's probably quite wrong to sort of criticise. But what one could see was he had been Sasso there, and all I could do was to compare him with John Grandy, who took over, and I was with John Grandy for, I suppose, less than 10 days at the handover stage. But John Grandy came out, who knew far less about 2nd Tactical Air Force, inevitably. But
he was an Air Marshal as well.
He took over from Edwards Jones, and then subsequently he had four very senior commands, and then was Chief of Air Staff, because he commanded the Far East Air Force after that. And
now, what was Grandy like?
Well, Grandy, I was very impressed, really, with him as a commander, you know, and in a way you felt perhaps delegated much more, because I think in a way you could see both sides of EJ. Really knew one hell of a lot about things because he had been Sasso out there before, but one felt in a way he might have had too tight a grip on some of the smaller things rather than the very big picture. But The other way around, I liked him as an individual, and inevitably you had to get on really with the commander's wife, and she was very pleasant, I must say. Lady Edwards Jones, she'd learned to fly before the Air Force, before the war, and had she was from the Port family, the Graham's Port family, and she'd done quite a lot of flying herself.
Now, how did you find John Grandy as a person? Then? I mean,
well, really, it was just a very quick, And the rather strange thing, which I don't know how well it worked, but his ADC had come out, Nigel Lane, a very sort of handsome, good-looking sort of bloke, Nigel, and he'd come off 43, which I was to join later, and after his first tour. But the rather strange thing was that both of them were brand new to the command, which struck me as being a bit odd, because obviously the personal staff officer would be changing quite quickly after that. But you'd think that one of them really should have known the command, and it struck me that John Grandy would have been better placed to have somebody that knew the command well coming out like that. But no, I